Remember last time that I was saying that as long as a messenger RNA transcript still exists, in other words, until it's destroyed, until it's digested, it will continue to be able to be transcribed, right? Well, here in slide 19, we see that an mRNA doesn't even have to finish being transcribed before it can start being transcribed again. What we see here in the figure is an example of what's called a polyribosome. A polyribosome is one mRNA transcript, which is the red thing, and several different ribosomes simultaneously transcribing that same transcript, but in different stages of transcription. So the ribosomes here are moving from left to right. They're starting on the left and moving to the right. So this one near the right edge has already completed its polypeptide. You can see it's been released, and the ribosome is going to release from the mRNA. This one to the left of it is not quite done, and this one's even less done, and this one's still less done. So they're in different parts of the completion of polypeptides, but they're all translating. Did I say transcription earlier? Yes. Damn it, I meant translation, sorry. A single mRNA being simultaneously translated by different ribosomes. And each of these lavender polypeptides are identical, or will be once they're completed. The point is that the mRNA transcript doesn't have to wait until a ribosome is all the way off of it before another one can come along. As soon as there's enough room at the start of the transcript, a new ribosome can come there and clamp on and start another translation to make another copy of that same polypeptide. It's a lot more efficient than waiting until its translation ends before you start it again, right? And we call that whole thing, that whole complex of a messenger RNA and all the ribosomes, a polyribosome. Now to 20. What is the difference between a free ribosome and a bound ribosome? No, a ribosome never has its own membrane because it's not a membrane-bounded organelle, which is why it's no problem that you have it in a prokaryotic cell. Right? Prokaryotic cells don't have membrane-bounded organelles, but they do have ribosomes because they have to make proteins, and that's the job of ribosomes.
The fact that there's some ribosomes that are stuck in like a rough ER, as opposed to some that are kind of floating around, not to say in the ether.
That's right. A free ribosome is not connected to a membrane at the moment. For it to be free, it means it's just in the cytoplasm. A bound ribosome at the moment is attached to a membrane, specifically the membrane that makes up the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And what is the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum?
Send package ribosomes to Golgi, or then
It doesn't package ribosomes. What are the packages that get sent?
Vesicles.
Made out of membrane from that ER, but what do they contain? The vesicles. Proteins, and therefore the job of the rough ER is to do what? No? The job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made proteins. And not all proteins need such modification. Remember back when we were talking about transcription, the first part of gene expression, we talked about post-transcriptional modification. That's post-transcriptional modification of mRNA, which is what's produced during transcription, right? Transcription is done, and then you modify the product, which is mRNA in that case. That's post-transcriptional modification of mRNA. Well, translation produces a different product, right? The polypeptide. And some polypeptides do not need to be modified after they're produced by translation. They can just go start doing their job, whatever it is. Other proteins, on the other hand, do need to be modified after translation creates them. And that's why those modifications are called post-translational modifications of the polypeptides. All right? So the question is, therefore, how does the cell know which polypeptides are going to need to be modified and which ones will not need to be modified? Well, we'll get into this in a minute, but first let me say that all translation starts on a free ribosome, a ribosome that is not attached to any membrane, just in the cytoplasm. And so that applies to, since I said all proteins, that means polypeptides that don't need to be modified and polypeptides that do need to be modified. They all start out being created on a ribosome that's not attached to a membrane, a free ribosome. Polypeptides that will need to be modified, like any polypeptide, is made up of a sequence of amino acids. But for the ones that are going to need to be modified, the first several amino acids form a specific sequence that actually serves as a signal to the cell saying, I am one of these polypeptides that need to be modified. And it's not necessarily the first three like it is in the green sequence right here, but it's a sequence of amino acids serving as a signal. So the signal is actually part of the polypeptide itself. But it's at the end it's the beginning of the polypeptide, where it's first being elongated. If the polypeptide has that signal peptide, as it's called, that's one protein already, right? The emerging elongating polypeptide is a protein. That's the one that's being built. But the signal, which is part of that emerging polypeptide, is recognized by another protein in the cytoplasm, the orange thing in the cartoon, called a signal recognition particle, SRP. And this is very similar to the specificity between an enzyme and its substrate. That's how the signal recognition particle is able to recognize the signal peptide, has just the right shape. And so this is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein. Right? The ligand is itself a protein, and it's binding to a signal recognition particle, which is another protein. And that reception of the signal causes the entire translation complex, which is the mRNA, both of the ribosomal subunits, the emerging polypeptide, plus the signal recognition particle to which the polypeptide is attached, to translocate, to move from the cytoplasm over to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, shown in blue here. And not only move over to it, but dock to it. And not just anywhere on the membrane, but specifically to a complex of yet more protein that's involved in this process, forming a little pore, just like it's not the same kinds of proteins, but it's very similar to a nuclear pore, which is a complex of proteins in the nuclear envelope arranged with a hollow tunnel-like passageway. That's called a translocation complex, but it's a pore still, it's a hole. And The signal recognition particle, which in a sense is carrying the whole translation complex, is able to bind to the translocation complex itself, to the pore in the membrane. And when it does, that binding happens in just the right way to line up the still elongating polypeptide that's being built to the center of that pore, so that as translation continues and it gets longer and longer, the polypeptide will be strung through the pore and end up in the lumen, or the hollow interior, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly where a polypeptide that needs to be modified should be, because that's the job of the rough ER, to modify the protein. So translation always starts on a free ribosome. If the polypeptide that's being built does not have one of these signal peptides, then nothing is going to recognize it. No signal recognition particle is going to recognize it, and it will not only start out as on a free ribosome, but it will go through the entire translation process on a free ribosome and be released just in the cytoplasm, which is appropriate in that case because it's not one of the ones that need to be modified, right? So it will just assume its three-dimensional shape based purely on, like all polypeptides, on its sequence of amino acids, in other words, on its primary structure, and it will start doing its job, whatever that shape allows it to do. All right, let's go to 21. And talk a little bit more about mutation. We just barely talked about mutation so far in this course, and we'll talk about it more in other chapters after the upcoming exam. But mutation is any change in DNA sequence. Now, mutation, as we'll talk more about later, is the original source of all genetic variation. Without mutation, all organisms would be identical copies of the original successful organism that is the ancestor to all of us. We're not, though, right? There are all kinds of different species with all kinds of individuals within those species, and they're genetically different from each other because mutation has occurred along the way. But mutation, however it happens, and it can be by any sort of mechanism, including simply a mistake being made in the process of producing DNA, any mutation, though, causes a difference in a DNA sequence compared to the DNA that was in the previous generation or earlier in the cell's life. Notice on the left we have what's called wild-type DNA. Well, it has obviously been mutated as well compared to the first DNA that ever existed. But wild-type is the name we give to the version of DNA that you see most often in a population. In this case, humans. And then, by comparison to the wild type, anything that differs from it is considered mutant, because mutations have created a different sequence of DNA in those mutant individuals. Now, this is an example that we already looked at in an earlier chapter. This is a mutation that leads to sickle cell disease in humans. And it involves hemoglobin. But hemoglobin, first of all, is, maybe you'll remember from the picture, it's a multimeric protein, meaning it's made up of multiple polypeptides, right? Well, in the case of hemoglobin, there are four overall polypeptides, but there's two copies of one type and two copies of another type. So four overall polypeptides, but two different kinds of polypeptides. And therefore, to make one hemoglobin requires actually two different genes, because each gene specifies how to make one of the two kinds of polypeptides. And one of those genes is not affected by this mutation. It's totally normal. The one that is affected by the mutation is the only one of the two genes shown here. And not even nearly all of that gene. A gene can be broken into triplets because that's how messenger RNA gets read as triplets, right, called codons. So we see just the one triplet that includes the mutation here. The other triplets are not affected, and they will be exactly the same in both versions, the wild type and the mutant. Mutations can be they can be very, very specific, meaning affect just one nucleotide. But since it's DNA, there are two strands, right? So one nucleotide, one position, is actually two nucleotides, one on each strand. And that's why we use the phrase base pair. A pair of nitrogenous bases is really one nucleotide in each of the two strands at the same position. That's the smallest possible mutation, and we call those point mutations when they affect just a single base pair. Later we'll talk about much more widespread mutations involving entire chromosomes. That's a different chapter. But this shows you that even a point mutation can have a profound effect. So all of the other triplets not shown here are not being changed. Those are not being mutated. And not even this whole triplet is being mutated, just the middle nucleotide. In the wild type, this position of the gene is CTT, as you see on the top strand, which is the one that it gets read in transcribing this gene. Well, the complement of CTT in messenger RNA is GAA, right? So the messenger RNA gets built, and in this position, there's GAA. When you look up GAA in the genetic code, which is what translation does effectively, GAA corresponds to glutamic acid, which is what the GLU stands for. That's just one of many amino acids in that one polypeptide that of the four that make up hemoglobin. All the other amino acids are not even listed because they don't change in the two humans, a normal and a mutant. But glutamic acid is the amino acid that, if it is in position, will lead to normally shaped hemoglobin polypeptides, and therefore the hemoglobin is normal, does its normal function of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide. And in that person, there is no sickle cell disease. The point mutation occurs, though, to this middle nucleotide of the three in this triplet. So instead of CTT, it ends up being CAT for whatever reason. That's the mutation. Well, CAT, of course, has the complement GUA rather than GAA. And when that gets transcribed, it just follows instructions. It doesn't know it's a mutation, right? It's just following instructions. It makes GUA in the transcript, and then it translates it into the amino acid that corresponds to GUA, which is not glutamic acid. GUA in the genetic code corresponds to valine, a different amino acid. All the other amino acids are just like the normal hemoglobin. This one amino acid is different. And that, of course, affects its shape, because the shape of any polypeptide is based on what the sequence of amino acids is. And sometimes a change of just one amino acid doesn't really profoundly affect anything. It might still be pretty much the correct shape. Other times it can be profound, like in sickle cell disease. Just that one amino acid being different misshapes it so much that it can't do the job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide and causes other problems as well. So it's a bad thing to have, sickle cell disease, caused by just a point mutation, tiny, tiny change in the information. Well, that's a specific example in 21, but in 22, we're looking at categories of mutations rather than specific examples. You have a wild type DNA at the top, and all the ones in the boxes below are variations on that, mutated variations. But in the left column, all of these examples are categorized as base pair substitutions. Now think about what that word means. If you're substituting a base pair, that means you're not changing the length of the gene. You're not changing how many nucleotides are in that gene sequence, because something gets substituted for something else. It's a swap out. All right, so only that nucleotide in that position is affected. Everything else is still there and in its correct position. The overall length doesn't change. And therefore, the effect isn't nearly as great or potentially as great. But this can cause different things to happen, including nothing at all. In the top left example, you have what's called a silent mutation. It has nothing to do with sound, but it's called silent because it doesn't have any effect, actually. In the wild type, at this position, notice that the triplet is CCG, and that gets transcribed as GGC, which gets translated into glycine as the amino acid, because GGC in the genetic code stands for glycine. In this silent mutation, instead of CCG originally, it's now CCA. That's the point mutation. Well, cell doesn't know it's mutated. It just transcribes that new version. CCA, complementarily, gets transcribed into GGU instead of GGC. And when you look up GGU in the genetic code, it still specifies glycine. In other words, silent mutations are possible because of the redundancy of the genetic code. Since 64 is greater than 20, you have multiple codons that can specify the same amino acid. So yes, it is a mutation. The DNA is different. The mRNA will be different. But the final product, the polypeptide, will be the same as if no mutation ever happened. And therefore, the trait, which is directly caused by the protein, remember, not the DNA, is not affected at all in a silent mutation. But below that, you have what's called a missense. A missense mutation is one that, by analogy with language, gets one word of a sentence wrong. Codons are like words in a sentence, where the sentence is the overall polypeptide. And missense might have a big effect or not. Depends on the importance of that one word, right? But that's what missense is. What's happened here is that instead of CCG, it's now TCG. That's the mutation. TCG gets transcribed into AGC. And when you look up AGC in the genetic code, it is not glycine, it's serine. So this is exactly what happened in the previous slide for sickle cell disease. It's missense because one codon is now specifying a different amino acid from the compared to the wild type. The rest of the polypeptide is okay, though. Well, that might make a difference. It might not. And by the way, when I say difference, I don't necessarily mean it's not doing its job as well. Mutations happen randomly, but every once in a while, a random mistake will produce a new polypeptide that actually does a better job than the wild type one had been doing in the population up to that point. And that's exactly what natural selection acts on. If an individual happens to have that mutation that it makes an even better protein than the normal population, it will have a better chance at surviving long enough to pass that mutant better gene on to the next generation. And so that's why there are different species. Gradually, these mutations that are favorable get selected for, and populations evolve over time. But anyway, that's what missense is, getting one word of a sentence wrong, basically. On the other hand, you can have nonsense, Nonsense is more than getting one word in the sentence wrong. It's getting many words wrong. The same exact thing is happening. These are all point mutations. But now it's this triplet. Instead of it being TTC, it mutates into ATC. ATC gets transcribed into UAG instead of AAG. And this is what makes it nonsense. When you look up UAG in the genetic code, it doesn't specify any amino acid. It's one of the three stop codons. So however many amino acids it's added up to this point, even though it's not supposed to be nearly done yet, it will think it's supposed to be done. It makes a shorter polypeptide than it's supposed to make because it prematurely stops. And that is very, very unlikely for that shorter protein to actually work, right? Depending on how short it is. So nonsense has a much more drastic effect in the individual than a missense does, but it happens for the same reason. Now, those were all substitutions. Like I said, there's no change in the overall number of nucleotides. On the right half, though, we have what are called base pair insertions and deletions. And either of these two, an insertion or a deletion, does change the number of nucleotides in the DNA. The DNA gets either longer or shorter because of an insertion or a deletion. Insertions, of course, are mutations that add a nucleotide. So a different nucleotide gets stuffed in between two that were there and everything else shifts. And a deletion takes one out. Well, this has much more far-reaching effects as far as the trait is concerned compared to a substitution. And that's because it causes what's called a frame shift. The frame here that gets shifted is the reading frame. Now, I keep using the analogy with language because the genetic code really is kind of a language where the words are the codons. Each codon has a meaning, specifically an amino acid. Just like in English, each word has a meaning that's part of a sentence. The difference, well, English uses words of varying lengths. It can be one word, like one letter is a whole word, like I or a. It can be a very long word, right? We don't have any problem when we're reading, though, telling where words begin and end. And why is that? Yes, we have spaces between words. There aren't any spaces between words in messenger RNA. It's a whole one sequence of A's, U's, C's, and G's. But the difference is that in the language of translation, words are not variable in length. Every word is three letters long. So you don't need spaces. You just read things three letters at a time. That's fine as long as you start in the right place. That's what sets the frame. So that start codon, which is the AUG one, says, okay, these are three, and therefore the next three is the next word, and so on. Well, if you have an insertion or a deletion, you shift the frame. And it's probably best to just use an analogy with a sentence made up of only three-letter words. You know, like the red cat ate the owl. Has a certain meaning, right? Well, if you were just doing a substitution mutation, you might say that this is red becomes rod. That would be missense because you've gotten one word wrong. It affects the overall meaning, but you might still be able to tell what it was supposed to be. If you have an insertion mutation, though, that would be like, let's say, putting a Z in between the R and the E and the D there. And everything else shifts. So that's going to make the new sentence, the R-E-Z DCA, T-A-T, E-T-H, E-O-W. See where I got those? Everything shifted. That's the frame shift. And it would shift the other way if you had a deletion. Well, the ribosome doesn't know that mutation existed, that a frame shift has occurred. It's still going to start keep reading words three letters at a time. And this means that a frame shift not only affects the amino acid for the codon the mutation occurs in, but it's also going to affect every codon after that. And so it basically will make a completely random protein that's not even close to the intended protein. And the chance of that actually working for whatever the job that protein has is effectively zero. That's why the effects are so much more profound. But also notice that this reinforces what I said toward the beginning of the term. DNA does not directly give an organism its traits. The proteins do. And if a change in DNA means that you now end up making a different protein, that's why the trait is different, because the protein is different. Well, insertions and deletions causing frame shifts can have, they can cause nonsense by having a premature stop codon. That's what nonsense is, premature stop codon. Or they can cause extensive missense, like I was just showing you with that sentence, where from the point of the mutation onward, every word is basically wrong. This is something that doesn't occur in eukaryotic cells, but it does in prokaryotic cells, and that's because of the fundamental difference we discussed as far as gene expression is concerned when you compare prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. Gene expression includes transcription and translation, right? Well, transcription in all cells has to happen where the DNA is, because only transcription of those two processes, only transcription directly involves DNA. It has to occur wherever the DNA is. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm where the ribosomes are. But for a prokaryotic cell, that's the same compartment. Cytoplasm has the DNA. The cytoplasm is where translation occurs also. So transcription and translation occur in the same compartment. Don't have that situation in a eukaryotic cell. Transcription has to end before translation can begin in a eukaryote, because you have to post-transcriptionally modify that RNA to get it out of the nucleus to get it to the cytoplasm where it can then be translated. You don't have that complication in a prokaryotic cell. So what we see here is that in a prokaryotic cell, messenger RNA doesn't even have to be completely created, transcribed, before translation can start, because it doesn't have to go into a different compartment. So this is one gene, the blue thing, that is being simultaneously transcribed by multiple different RNA polymerases at different positions along the gene. Each one is producing an identical copy of red messenger RNA, but they're in different stages of completeness, right? And as soon as there is enough mRNA hanging off for a ribosome to come along and clamp on, it will, and start translating the messenger RNA before the messenger RNA is even done. So we have multiple polyribosomes simultaneously being produced on one gene in a prokaryotic cell, which means that in prokaryotic cells, you can really, in very short order, get a lot of copies of the polypeptide built, much shorter time than it would take in a eukaryotic cell, which can be a big deal because prokaryotes are unicellular, right? And if they really need that protein, it's important. You can't afford the death of one cell if you only have one cell. So we can't do that, but prokaryotic cells can. And that leaves just 24 for the unit. And this is nothing new. I've already gone through all of this, but it's good to go through a summary slide like this. This is a summary of all of gene expression, and specifically in a eukaryotic cell. You can see this is a eukaryotic cell. It has a nucleus. But gene expression includes transcription first and then translation. Remember, it's called transcription because it's not a change in language. You're staying within the language of nucleotides, but you're transcribing, you're rewriting the code that's in the DNA, which has to stay in the library, into the form of messenger RNA, which is also the language of nucleotides. So that involves RNA polymerase binding to a promoter, which is the beginning of a gene, and separating the two strands of DNA, using just one of them. The other one just gets moved out of the way temporarily. And that template strand, its sequence of DNA nucleotides, tells the RNA polymerase molecule which specific RNA nucleotides to add to make the RNA transcript. And since this is a eukaryotic cell, what is transcribed is at first called the pre-mRNA because it has to undergo post-transcriptional modification, which comes in two major forms. First, it has to the pre-mRNA has to get its ends put on, which are the 5' cap and the poly A tail. And also, the second major post-transcriptional modification is the splicing, in which the introns are removed and the exons are end-to-end linked to form the mature, ready-to-go, finalized version of messenger RNA, which is in the nucleus and therefore has to go to where translation occurs out in the cytoplasm. Well, that's done because of the nuclear pores that allow for that modified messenger RNA to get through. Out in the cytoplasm, translation occurs, but that involves initiation of translation, which is the building of the translation complex. Remember that the ribosomal subunits are not together. There's just a bunch of small subunits, a bunch of large subunits in the pool. And when the messenger RNA comes along and binds to one of these small subunits, then the large subunit can come. Now that's just part of it. You also have to have tRNA bringing in the amino acids and producing the correct sequence of amino acids to make the correct polypeptide, in other words, requires reading the mRNA one codon at a time, which amounts to allowing in next just the right kind of aminoacyl tRNA, meaning the kind of aminoacyl tRNA that's allowed to carry that particular kind of amino acid that corresponds to the codon. And the reason that's ensured is because there has to be complementarity between the codon and the anticodon of the aminoacyl tRNA. Any other kind of aminoacyl tRNA will not be allowed in at that moment. And then once that occurs, that new amino acid comes in, then however many amino acids are already being carried by the peptidyl tRNA get transferred from that tRNA to the amino acid being carried by the aminoacyl tRNA, which in effect makes this new tRNA now a peptidyl tRNA, and it makes the former peptidyl tRNA an uncharged tRNA, which gets put into the E slot and then injected. When the shift is made, that will read a new codon, which will allow for a new aminoacyl tRNA bringing the correct next amino acid in to continue the elongation. Eventually, it will hit a stop codon, any one of the three, and that will tell the whole complex, you've already added the last required amino acid. Time to disintegrate the whole thing. The polypeptide is now on its own, and the RNA is still intact, so the same thing can happen again. But that translation complex is done and disassembles. All right, any questions? In that case, don't forget to bring a Scantron.